The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
I'm Michael Tomasky, and this is Guardian Daily for Friday, September 5th.
Let me just offer an advance warning to the old big spending, do nothing, me first, country second crowd. Change is coming.
The battle lines have been drawn, but will America go back to the future and choose John McCain as its next president?
Americans are ambitious by nature, and we face greater challenges. It's time for us to show the world again how Americans lead.
I'm John Dennis. Also in today's Guardian Daily, new research indicates that teachers unconsciously discriminate against black Caribbean school pupils.
I think this is an instance of institutional racism, but it doesn't mean there's any conscious discrimination on the part of teachers or other individuals in schools.
Also today, after figures showing the worst August for the car industry for more than 40 years, we consider the companies that are doing rather well out of the credit crunch.
Middle-class customers are shopping at Aldi. Their sales are up 20%, and they've hired celebrity TV chef Phil Vickery to do some credit crunch recipes for them, and he's also doing them on a podcast.
And The Guardian's John Henley previews his new TV series that looks at the history of the housing market.
I bought that flat, and we needed to borrow less than twice our kind of joint annual income. If we were in the same jobs now, to afford that same flat, we would need to borrow something like seven times our joint earnings.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But first, let's go to Bill Overton, who's got today's news headlines and the papers.
The Republican presidential candidate John McCain's promised he'll bring change to the US if he's elected president. Speaking as he accepted the party's nomination, Mr. McCain said that change is coming and attacked politicians, he said, went to Washington and worked for themselves rather than the electorate. It's being seen as a clear attempt to dismiss Barack Obama's claim that the senator would represent a third term of the failed policies of the Bush administration. Mr. McCain received a rousing standing ovation when he talked about his experiences as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, which he said had made him hate war. His speech, however, was briefly interrupted by anti-war protesters, with delegates chanting USA, USA to try and drown out the noise. The 72-year-old would be the oldest first-term president if he defeats Mr. Obama in November's election. Black Caribbean pupils are being subjected to institutional racism in English schools, which could dramatically undermine their chances of academic success, according to a new study. Researchers have uncovered evidence suggesting that assumptions about behavioural problems mean youngsters' other talents are being overlooked. The findings are based on a survey which tracked 15,000 pupils through the education system and add weight to the theory that low achievement among some black students is made worse because teachers don't expect them to succeed. Black education groups have welcomed the findings and called for urgent action to be taken to stamp out any hidden racism in schools. And there's more on that story later in Guardian Daily. More than 120 people in Haiti have died following the latest in a series of tropical storms which have left the island's infrastructure devastated. The Guardian's correspondent in South America, Rory Carroll, reports thousands have been left homeless as the storms have caused flooding in much of the impoverished Caribbean island. Tropical Storm Fay started the crisis 3 weeks ago, followed by Hurricane Gustav, with Tropical Storm Hannah arriving on Tuesday. A further storm, Ike, has been gathering force in the Atlantic and it's feared could strike next week. The US Embassy in Port-au-Prince has declared a disaster situation and released $100,000 in emergency aid. Some officials say the death toll and scale of damage could be on a par with Tropical Storm Jean, which struck 4 years ago and left 2,000 dead. Sport now, and in football, speculation is growing for the second time in less than a year as to who'll take over from Kevin Keegan as manager of Newcastle United. Keegan quit as the Magpies manager for the second time yesterday after several days of uncertainty at the club, with the board insisting he was still in charge. In a statement, the former England manager said he'd been working desperately hard to find a way forward with the club's directors, but that had not proved possible. About 200 angry fans gathered outside St James's Park last night after hearing of his departure, calling for the club's owner Mike Ashley to quit. And Great Britain's team's gearing up for the Paralympic Games, which begin in Beijing tomorrow. Team GB will take part in 18 of the 20 sports in the Olympic programme. At the last Paralympics, Great Britain finished with 94 medals, including 35 golds. And the papers, The Telegraph and Mail, have front page pictures of the Republican convention, with the Mail quoting vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin, who described herself as a pit bull in lipstick. The Independent leads on a story about fears over long-haul flights. It follows the results of an inquiry which revealed a crash at Heathrow in January was probably caused by ice in the aircraft's fuel system. Meanwhile, no prizes for guessing what makes most back pages today, as football pundits analyse why Kevin Keegan's walked out of Newcastle after only 232 days in charge. As always, keep up to the minute at guardian.co.uk.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
We're going to recover the people's trust by standing up again to the values Americans admire. The party of Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Reagan is going to get back to basics.
Michael Tomasky here. We're in the convention hall. We've just heard John McCain give his acceptance speech. I think it's fair to say that it was a letdown to this crowd, and probably not a success as a speech, to put it mildly. This crowd was really electrified by Rudy Giuliani and especially by Sarah Palin, and really fired up, I think, tonight to finally come in here and get themselves revved up by a man they've never been that wild about. But he is their nominee. I think they were ready. And I don't think he gave a speech that that got people very turned on.
We face many dangerous threats in this dangerous world, but I'm not afraid of them. I'm prepared for them. I know how the military works, what it can do better, and what it shouldn't do. I know how the world works. I know the good and evil in it. I know how to work with leaders who share our dreams of a freer, safer, and more prosperous world, and how to stand up to those who don't.
The theme was his service to his country and patriotism and so on and so forth. And I would say that for the last 3 minutes of the speech, when he dwelled on that, he actually did probably score some points and have some success. What he didn't do at all was talk about what he's going to do about the economy, about the various problems that face this country. Remember, we're in a country where recent polls have shown upwards of 80% of people saying that the United States is headed on the wrong track and is in trouble. And I don't think he did anything tonight to acknowledge that and to say what he would do about it.
Again and again, I've worked with members of both parties to fix problems that need to be fixed. That's how I will govern as president. I will reach out my hand to anyone to help me get this country moving again. My friend,
it was definitely a bit of self-sabotage tonight. I mean, you should never rub your hands with glee in politics, because things can turn on a dime the next day and you never know what's going to happen. But after last night, I would suspect that the Obama people were a little bit worried that if McCain came in here and really knocked one out of the park, that it was going to be a big fight and that McCain and the Republicans were going to have the momentum. I think that McCain, frankly, lost a good bit of the momentum that had been gathered in this hall last night. Lost it tonight.
These are tough times for many of you. You're worried about keeping your job or finding a new one. All you've ever asked of your government is to stand on your side and not in your way, and that's what I intend to do. Stand on your side and fight for your future. And I found just the right partner to help me shake up Washington, D.C.
You could say that this convention was a story of two hurricanes, Hurricane Gustav and Hurricane Palin, or Hurricane Sarah. She really electrified this hall, and I bet that if you ask these delegates tonight, in an honest moment, who they'd rather have as their candidate, she would probably win that poll over John McCain tonight. But, you know, she obviously couldn't win a presidential election, so they've got the guy they've got.
I will keep taxes low and cut them where I can. My opponent will raise them. I will open new markets to our goods and services. My opponent will close them.
McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, hopes that the election is on personalities, because that's the only kind of election that John McCain could win, particularly if it's on Barack Obama's personality. And if they can raise enough questions about either his preparedness or his general profile as a human being, that's the only election that they can win. they can't win an election in which people are voting on the state of the country, the fate of the country, the condition that the country's in, because too many people are too persuaded that 8 years of Republican rule have been very bad for this country. And it's important to note, independents, if you look at polls and ask people a range of questions about how they feel about how things are in the United States, Republicans are very upbeat because they're trying to be supportive of their party. But Democrats and independents in these polls answer questions almost identically. So independents have, as a bloc, shifted very dramatically away from the Republican Party. And that's the warning sign for this party. McCain and Rick Davis know that they can't compete on the question of issues, so they just want to try to make it about Barack Obama.
I'm going to fight for my cause every day as your president. I'm going to fight to make sure every American has every reason to thank God as I thank him, that I'm an American, a proud citizen of the greatest country on earth. And with hard work, strong faith, and a little courage, great things are always within our reach. Fight with me. Fight with me.
So now the convention phase of the election is over, and we move to the next and final phase, which is the beginning of the home stretch. The most important thing that will happen is the three presidential debates. They'll take place from late September through mid-October. There's also a vice presidential debate in there, which will have more interest than usual. And in addition to those four major events, we'll have just constant campaigning, constant television ads, constant attacks, constant back and forth. Will either side have any kind of surprising endorsements? Will, for example, Colin Powell endorse Barack Obama, which is something that's been rumored about? Or will John McCain get another high-profile Democratic endorsement of some sort? How active a role will the Clintons play in behalf of Barack Obama? Hillary Clinton becomes somewhat more important now that there's a female vice presidential candidate on the Republican side, the Republican bid to get some of those Hillary voters. So that raises Hillary's role. And I'm sure the Obama campaign is trying to talk to her, plead with her, about playing a more active role there. This comes down to which campaign has more discipline, no leaks, no infighting that's exposed in the pages of the newspapers, discipline, focus, intensity. It comes down to which party is more unified and enthusiastic. I expect a very high turnout in this election. 122 million Americans voted in the 2004 election, and that was one of the highest numbers we'd had in 40 or 50 years. I think we're going to bust that to pieces this fall. I think we'll have maybe 130, maybe 140 million. From this point on, it's about discipline and mechanics.
Later in Guardian Daily, we'll hear how Sarah Palin's convention speech went down in her home state of Alaska. And there's more on the election campaigns from our reporting team in the United States at guardian.co.uk/America.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Also on The Guardian's website today, football. And if your nerves are fraying ahead of England's match tomorrow against Andorra, Rob Smythe selects the greatest international football upsets at blogs.guardian.co.uk/sport. London Fashion Week is coming up, and you can sign up to receive our free daily email from The Guardian with all the front row trends and backstage gossip at guardian.co.uk/fashion. And Tim Radford on how geoengineering could be a great job creation scheme for universities. That's at educationguardian.co.uk. Black Caribbean school pupils are victims of institutional racism, according to a study published today. It found that teachers have lower expectations of them. A tier system operates in the national curriculum where 14-year-old pupils are entered for tests at a level that matches their performance in the classroom. But for every three white British children entered for the most difficult exams at age 14, only two Black Caribbean pupils are entered. The research was led by Dr. Steve Strand at Warwick University.
We looked at attainment at 14 in national tests for this nationally representative sample of pupils, and a number of ethnic groups were achieving much lower levels in those tests than the white British pupils, and that included Pakistani, Bangladeshi, black African and black Caribbean pupils. What we were able to do then, because the data set is very rich, is look at other possible explanations for that gap. And a number of factors could explain the low attainment of the Pakistani, Bangladeshi and black African pupils. But we're very hard-pressed to actually explain why black Caribbean pupils were doing so poorly and making such poor progress between the age of 11 and 14 relative to our British pupils. So essentially we looked at a whole range of factors. We looked at greater likelihood of social and economic deprivation that is experienced by black Caribbean kids, but that didn't seem to explain the effects. We looked at those pupils' attitude to school, but there was no evidence that the black Caribbean pupils had any different attitude to school than white British pupils. We looked at mother's education. We looked at a whole range of factors. We looked at attendance. None of those factors were able to explain why black Caribbean pupils in particular made such poor progress between the age of 11 and 14.
What were the reasons then?
Well, we don't absolutely know, because these are sort of complex social problems with complex explanations. But one of the factors that may be implicated, almost by elimination really, is the role of teacher expectations. And one window on teacher expectations is to look at the tiers that they enter pupils for in the tests at age 14. So teachers have to make a judgment about what the likely level a pupil would achieve in the national tests, and then they put them in for a tier or a particular paper which is targeted at a certain level. And if you put in at a low level, you can't actually achieve a higher level in the test. So the teacher's judgment actually can have an impact on the actual levels that can be obtained by pupils in the tests. And what we found there was, again, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, black African and black Caribbean pupils were all underrepresented in entry to the higher tiers of those age 14 tests. Now, for the Pakistani, Bangladeshi and black African pupils, that could be accounted for by their low prior attainment when they were 11. So if you like, the entry patterns looked congruent for them. But for the black Caribbean pupils, there was no obvious explanation for that. So even when we controlled for the prior attainment of the pupils, and for social class and for social disadvantage and for a whole host of factors, attitudes to school, academic self-concept, the black Caribbean pupils are still underrepresented in entry to the higher test tiers relative to their white British peers.
And does this mean that there's evidence of institutional racism in the state education system?
That's quite a loaded term, but I would say yes, when you interpret institutional racism as organisational policies or actions that can have an unintended negative impact on a certain group. So I think this is an instance of institutional racism, but it doesn't mean there's any conscious discrimination on the part of teachers or other individuals in schools. But it does seem that this organisational arrangement impacts particularly negatively on black Caribbean pupils.
Dr. Steve Strand from Warwick University.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, we go to the town in Alaska whose mayor was at one time a certain Sarah Palin. And we sample the latest digital threat to the printed page, an electronic book. But first, as the economic downturn turns into a recession, there's increasing evidence of the way consumers are changing their spending habits. Shoppers are looking for cheaper food and clothes, bargain leisure activities and high return investments. Also experiencing a surge in demand are financial journalists, like our business editor Deborah Hargreaves.
Analysts are now calling it the Aldi effect, and you're seeing it come through in a lot of company results. You're finding that the companies that are doing best are those that are offering a discount brand, something cheaper, something slightly easier for consumers to spend their money on in the credit crunch.
Aldi have even launched their own podcast, which is a bit cheeky in my view.
Aldi is making a lot of the fact that middle-class customers are shopping at Aldi. Their sales are up 20% in recent months, and they've hired celebrity TV chef Phil Vickery to do some credit crunch recipes for them.
In the series, I'm going to show you how to make really simple, tasty food from quality ingredients. Not only do you get variety from Aldi, but you also get fantastic quality. It is as easy as that. serves four people for less than a tenner.
Credit Crunch Cuisine, it was a thing that Sainsbury's took up a few months ago with Jamie Oliver, of course.
That's right, feed your family for a fiver. Well, Aldi is going slightly better than that, although not cheaper. It's feed your family for 10 quid. And the first recipe is sea bass with sweet corn and cherry tomato salsa.
And we heard earlier this week that sales of baked beans are doing very well.
That's right. Everyone is cutting back. It's a real credit crunch. Yesterday we heard that Premier Inns was getting a lot of business customers as companies cut back on their travel budgets and people go to a cheap inn rather than a luxury hotel. There's a great quote from the chief exec which says, why would companies spend £100 on a luxury hotel when they could get just the same for £50 at Premier Inn? Yesterday also we saw car sales at their worst monthly figure for 40 years since 1966, and within those figures it showed that the real premium brands like Mercedes were doing very badly. Mercedes sales down 35%, whereas cheaper fuel efficient cars are actually increasing.
Merrill Lynch reported that there are more super rich than there were this time last year. But what could be the reasons for that? Why might the very rich be doing well?
Well, the very rich are usually insulated from things like a credit crunch. I mean, they live in a quite a different world from the rest of us. And their investments and their houses are largely kind of immune to the sort of downturn that the rest of us have taken on board. It's the middle income, middle Britain that are being affected by this. People are having to pay much more for their fuel and much more for their food bills because of inflation. And you find that redundancies are picking up as companies cut back during the credit crunch, so families are feeling very stretched.
Are there any differences in people's behaviour this time around from previous economic downturns?
There were some figures out yesterday showing that people are saving less. Our savings ratio is now the lowest since the 1950s, and that's particularly affected pensions. You're finding that there's a million fewer people than last year saving in a pension, and that's because they want to keep their money in a high interest deposit accounts so that it's available in case they need to use it during the crunch. But I think savings ratios have been falling quite rapidly in recent years as people have taken on big debts. And you're finding now that in this recession, we go into it more heavily indebted than we've ever been before. So if people start to suffer from falling house prices and see difficulties paying their mortgage, then you may find that they're losing their house, they're being repossessed much more quickly than before.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Well, staying on the subject of the housing market, after almost 20 years living abroad, The Guardian's John Henley returned to London a few years ago to find that the one-bedroom flat that he sold for £70,000 in 1987 is now worth just under £250,000. Well, that set him wondering, how did that happen? Well, he's been investigating why for a new television series called The Price of Property that begins next week. It looks at the various pressures on the housing market over the last few decades.
Despite the fact that kind of gentrification seems to have completely passed Acton by, apologies to any Actonians here, but listening. But this flat cost me £32,000 in 1985. I sold it a few years later for more or less double that, and I thought, well, I'm not going to do much better than that, really. Went off, lived in on the continent for 20 years, came back last year and discovered, to my complete horror, it was worth £250,000, the same flat. And the point, I mean, that's shocking enough, but the thing that really amazed me and that I find the evidence that this whole thing has just gone completely wrong, the housing market, is that, you know, I bought that flat with my now ex-wife, and we needed to borrow less than twice our kind of joint annual income to buy it. For the same, if we were in the same jobs now, roughly the same age, just out of university, etc., to afford that same flat, we would need to borrow something like seven times our joint earnings. And that, to me, you know, really, really underlined just how insane, or I mean, obscene, the housing market in Britain has become.
And what are the reasons for this? I mean, are the banks the only villains in this story?
The banks aren't the only villains. I mean, they play a very big part. They have played a very big part, that's certain. I mean, what's basically happened is that what should be a sort of a basic human right for everybody, a place to live, a roof over their heads, has been turned into a commodity like any other. There is a market in it. There's a particularly sort of cruel market in it. So what's happened? You've got people piling in who are wanting to make money out of it. So the banks, for sure, saw it as a way to make an awful lot of money. They lent 5 or 6 times people's salaries. They were making massive profits. And as long as prices continued to rise, which of course they were going to because everybody saw an interest in it, that was fine. Of course, now we're in a crunch. One side, at least, of the equation might be sorting itself out. But the effect of that has been that we've had a complete kind of mentality shift, really, and we now see, at least those of the Brits who are lucky enough to own a home and bought it sort of more than maybe 2 or 3 years ago, we now see homes as they're no longer just homes. They're our retirement. They're our pension. They're our children's education. They're our guarantee of kind of health, wealth, and happiness. And we have an incredible interest in maintaining that status quo. And that, at the root of it, is the problem.
John Henley and The Price of Property, a 4-part television series presented by John, begins on Monday at 9 p.m. on Channel 4. The Sony Reader has gone on sale. It's an electronic book. It weighs less than a hardback and it has enough memory to hold up to 160 novels. The Guardian's Peter Walker went along to its launch at a branch of Waterstones in London, where he spoke to the book chain's Deborah Tilley. He asked her what makes this device different.
The death of a book is an interesting thing, and obviously not something that we want to see. We're Waterstones, we love books. And this is just a different way of reading, really, in the same way that, music is now. You can take your music with you, you can now take your books with you, and a lot of them. So the book is here to stay, and this is just another way of reading.
I'm right in thinking also that people can download books from the Waterstones website.
We've launched waterstones.com/ebooks, which is the new ebook site. The reader comes with a package which is a bit like iTunes for your computer, which you load up and then you can download books from the site.
So the idea is, if in music terms you have the iPod and the iTunes site, this is the same kind of thing, is it?
Yeah, it's exactly the same.
Adrian Northover-Smith, I'm the Head of Products and Services Development for Sony UK.
There have been quite similar products launched in the past, and people have been predicting the death of a book for quite a long time. What makes this product different?
I don't think even now we're predicting the death of the book, if I'm honest. I think the two can absolutely coexist, and in fact it's more complementary to people's current reading habits. I found myself by a book at the airport, or 2 or 3 books, and you start one and you actually can't really get into it, or you're not really in the mood for it. So it enables people to take lots of books, experiment, and also kind of read new and different stuff that perhaps traditionally they wouldn't have been exposed to. The reader, with its internal memory, stores 160 books, but also it has 2 memory card slots that you can expand the memory and literally put thousands on there.
Do people really need to carry that many books around with them?
It depends. Obviously, people do like to walk around with their entire music collection. Why wouldn't people want to walk around with a vast selection of books to read as well?
I just noticed you're saying you're playing the Sony Reader for the first time. What's your initial thoughts?
Well, I've only been playing about with it for a couple of minutes, but it looks very impressive. I can well imagine that it would be something which I'd be interested in, especially when I'm travelling. I rather suspect that what's going to happen over the next few years is that a hard copy of the book is probably going to be sold, and maybe have a CD-ROM with it so that you can put it in and have a portable copy as well.
Do you have lots of books at home?
Yes, huge quantity, hardback, paperback, you name it.
Thousands, do you think?
Probably, yeah.
Could you imagine throwing them all in a skip and having an e-book?
Absolutely not in entirety. I've just done an edit of my book collection, thrown out a few that could bear to part with. But I think it has its uses for travel. Having just come back from holiday, touting around with 8 or 9 books in my bag, I still think nothing beats a physical book, and I'm never without one, especially on the tube in London. But for a long business trip or a long holiday, I've actually travelled around with books ripping pages out as I go to lighten the load, which is sacrilege, but this might make it more convenient.
Peter Walker reporting from Waterstones. We heard earlier in the programme about the reception that the Republican presidential candidate, John McCain, got at the party convention in Minnesota. But the highlight of the week for many Republicans was the speech on Wednesday by McCain's vice presidential running mate, Sarah Palin. The Guardian's Ed Pilkington has been to Wasilla, the town where Palin used to be mayor, to find out what the people there think of her.
We're in the world-famous Mugshot Saloon, a bar in Wasilla, which is the town of 7,000 people where Sarah Palin used to be mayor. And I'm with the bartender.
Dana Rush.
What do you think of her having been your mayor for several years?
I think she did an awesome job. I think she's very capable. And I would hope that she makes it for vice president. I think it's a great pick. And watch them knock their socks off.
What is it you like about her in particular?
She's weeded out the bad seeds in that we've had in our government that I'm sure everybody's aware of, and she's done excellent for the economy. She's helping us out with our energy program and stuff, and she's doing good.
Florin and Tony are with me. Have you had one of the bar's special Sarah Palin sausage pizzas for $8, I just noticed on the wall?
Yes. No, it's a great pizza.
You had it already?
Oh, yeah. Yes, very much. Very much indeed.
So what's your view of the governor of Alaska?
She's a very, very stunning person that should be right where she's at in her life and her time. She did a lot for us in Alaska, and I believe that she'll do great for our national convention.
There's been a little comment in the national press about maybe she's a liability, a lack of foreign experience, and the talk of the pregnancy of her daughter. Does any of this bother you?
No, not at all. Sarah's got actually more experience than Barack Obama that's running on the other presidential candidate. Sarah's got 12 years in government, where Barack Obama's got 10 to 12 years, but his has only been as a senator. Hers has been as a mayor of a city and governor of this great state of Alaska.
She's known for being very religious and pro-gun and anti-abortion. You got a gun yourself?
Oh, yeah, I got all kinds of guns. I hunt moose and caribou and stuff, and yeah.
How would you describe her stance on abortion?
She doesn't believe in abortion.
And that's something, obviously, that's important to you?
Yes, it is. Very, very important to me. With my religious background and growing up, and I've got 10 grandchildren myself, so, you know, for abortion, I would not have those 10 grandchildren.
And what would she bring, in your view, to Washington if she and Senator McCain were to win in November?
Yeah, her strength, you know, her backing, and how she will cross over party lines, and very strong woman.
So that's the view of the people at the bar of the Mugshot Saloon here in Wasilla, which is the small town that Sarah Palin used to be running as mayor.
We're a great town, yes.
Ed Pilkington. Today's programme was produced by Andy Duckworth and Sonia Rothwell, and in Minnesota, Ben Green. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.